Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, U.S. and European leaders decried the death of Russian activist Alexei Navalny, with many placing responsibility squarely on the Kremlin for the passing of President Vladimir Putin's most prominent domestic political opponent. Navalny was 47 and was declared dead as official campaigning for the March 17th presidential election, in which Putin is likely to secure a fifth term, was set to start. President Biden earlier today from the White House condemned Navalny's death. Here's what he had to say.
Responsible for Navalny's death. Putin is responsible. We're looking at a whole number of options. That's all I'll say right now.
Well, let's get to the interview. For more on the implications of the Putin critic's death and what it means inside and outside of Russia, we're joined right now by Ariel Cohen, non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, also a member of the Council of Foreign Relations. Dr. Cohen joins us from Washington, D.C. Dr. Cohen, your reaction when you woke up this morning and you saw that Alexei Navalny had died?
I'm extremely saddened, but I cannot say I'm surprised. Putin decapitated its opposition 10 years ago. He murdered my friend, Boris Nemtsov, the other opposition leader. And now Alexei, after they tried to poison Navalny, and then miraculously he was saved. He was flown to Germany, saved then. And then he made a brave decision to go back to Russia and to fight for freedom, for his ideas. This is a huge blow to the Russian opposition. I compare it with the death of Martin Luther King Jr., the murder of MLK, and imagine for a moment that Nelson Mandela would have been killed in the South African jail. But we won't see mass outpourings of protest in Russia because under Putin, Russia became much more authoritarian, borderline totalitarian. In many respects, it reminds me of late Stalin period, not even the Soviet Union of my youth under Leonid Brezhnev.
Dr. Cohen, what kind of clarity do we have right now on what actually happened with the death of Navalny?
Navalny was put in an Arctic jail in the far, far north, on the coast of the Arctic Ocean. He was in the most harsh conditions, but he was in a good mood just yesterday when he was interviewed for another case that the regime was piling against him. And the sudden death, of course, would require an investigation that is not going to happen in Putin's Russia. His wife is intending to fly to Russia. That's also an act of bravery. But most of the opposition, as I said, is either exiled or some of the leaders killed. We have Vladimir Karamurza, the columnist for the Washington Post, in the Russian jail, sentenced to 25 years after they also tried to poison him twice. And you have hundreds of people in Russia now, prisoners of conscience, fighters for the freedom of speech and liberty. You can go to many years in jail in Russia today for a Facebook post or a comment or anything they can interpret as defamation of the Russian military.
Dr. Cohen, this comes at a time ahead of President Putin running for re-election yet again. Widely believed he will win by a large majority, as he has in many elections in the past, 24 years at this point. I'm wondering what power you think the Russian people have at this point to actually protest or rise up against the regime.
The discussion in Moscow is always about the numbers. The late Boris Nemtsov said, if we bring 1 million people into the streets, which happened before the collapse of the Soviet Union, they had 1 million people in the streets, then the regime will be over because the police will be too intimidated and weak to try and kill 1 million people. On the other hand, if it's 1,000 people, they can be surrounded, beaten up, taken to jail, etc. So it's a matter of numbers. In my opinion, I started in this business about 40 years ago in audience research. In my opinion, about 60% of the Russian population, maybe more, support Putin and his war in Ukraine. This is, of course, when you have television totally dominated by Putin and the Kremlin. Imagine if in this country, we had CNN, ABC, Fox, Bloomberg, etc., all dominated by one man. So, under those conditions, not unlike Stalin's Soviet Union or Brezhnev's Soviet Union, or for that matter, Hitler's Germany, a majority, but not an absolute majority, supports the regime, and a pretty significant minority doesn't like it or hates it. And we saw 1 million people leaving Russia after reinvasion of Ukraine in February 22.
How does this further inflame tensions now between Russia and the US?
I think that this murder brings in high relief the nature of the regime. Of the satellite nuclear weapon that Putin may deploy in space in violation of applicable international treaties. So it is decapitating the opposition. We learn about the plans to expand the war after Ukraine, possibly attacking the Baltic states and also deploying the banned weapon in space.
It's something we heard the president asked about a little earlier in the day when he did make those comments from the White House on the death of Alexei Navalny. We also heard him, Dr. Cohen, say, Putin is responsible. We're looking at a whole number of options. That's all I'll say right now. Help me understand what options the United States and Europe actually has in retaliating against Putin for this, given that Russia is already under so many sanctions as a result of its invasion of Ukraine.
Russia is under some sanctions, and initially they stung, but now we see the Russian economy is in pretty anemic growth, but growth nevertheless, maybe about 1% a year, maybe less. But it didn't collapse. So, for example, Russia is exporting LNG, liquefied natural gas. It's not under sanctions. The exports of LNG to France in 23 grew 43%. And at the same time, the Biden administration announced that they're going to block future approvals of LNG exporting infrastructure, which scares our European and Asian allies who are the buyers of LNG. Next, Russia is exporting nuclear reactors. Russia is exporting weapons. Russia is still using the international banking system. We actually buy uranium fuel for our nuclear reactors from Russia because successive administrations, Republicans and Democrats, abandoned American nuclear industry. So there's a lot we can do. We can reshore and friendshore a lot of industries like titanium,
right,
that Boeing was buying from Russia. So there's a lot we can do. And there's $300 billion of Russian money parked in the West. And the big question is, at what point this money will go for the Ukrainian war effort, especially if Republicans are not allowing financing of the Ukrainian war through the U.S. assistance.
Dr. Cohen, that's exactly where I want to go. Just we have 30 seconds left here, but we did hear President Biden in those comments from the White House tying funding to Ukraine to the death of Navalny earlier in his comments. 30 seconds. Is that strategy actually going to work?
It depends. All we need now is for Mike Johnson, the speaker, to allow the Ukrainian assistance legislation to go to the floor, because on the floor of the House, there's a majority of Republicans and Democrats who will vote for assistance. It is President Biden, ex-President Biden, and Mike Johnson who are preventing this assistance to go for the vote. And as a result, thousands of Ukrainians, civilians, and soldiers are dying.
Dr. Ariel Cohen is a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center, also a member of the Council of Foreign Relations, joining us from Washington, D.C. this afternoon. Dr. Cohen, really appreciate you taking the time.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
This probably will not surprise you, but for younger generations in the U.S., it's difficult for many of them to imagine retirement. Roughly 21% of Americans ages 22 to 34 said retirement is out of reach or not part of the plan. This is from a recent TIAA Institute survey. And it's easy to see why. Good entry-level jobs are getting harder to come by, student debt burdens are daunting, and the cost of living in so many places is high. But what do things look like for older Americans, those people who are closer to retirement? This is something that should perhaps be on your radar since their retirement is coming up much sooner. Nate Miles is head of retirement at Allspring Global Investments. He joins us from Charlotte, North Carolina. Nate, good to have you on the program this afternoon. Allspring released the results of a recent survey on retirement this week. Going through the results, one thing that really surprised me was the disconnect between how advisors see their clients versus how the clients see themselves when it comes to being prepared for retirement. There's a big delta there, a big gap there. What's going on?
Yeah, I think part of that, Tim, is just a reflection of the fact that a lot of individual investors don't know what they don't know. When we ask them questions around things like their knowledge of Social Security, their knowledge of Medicare, long-term planning, estate planning, what we find is that once they actually leverage an advisor, they tend to be more confident in their own ability to answer those questions, but less confident in their ability to answer them without the help of an advisor. So I think part of the what's going on there is that individual investors don't know what they don't know. It's kind of like asking them 100 people who's a better than average driver, and you'll get 90 people that say yes. We think that's happening in some of that data as well.
What are some of the economic implications if in this country we have so many people thinking that they're not prepared for retirement?
Yeah, I think what's interesting in the data is that while we show retirees are better prepared for retirement, more secure in their retirement, there really is no discernible difference in the data between the preparedness of near retirees and retirees. The main difference is that one's retired and the other group is still working. We think it's more a matter of the fear of the unknown, right? This idea that I've been thinking about retirement for 2, 5, 10, 15 years, it's right around the corner. How do I transition from being a worker that's getting a paycheck every 2 weeks, every month, to someone who has to create their own paycheck? And it's a reflection more, I believe, of the change in focus of near retirees versus retirees, a change in focus from one where when I'm working, I'm worried about the value of my portfolio, to when I retire, I'm more focused on the income that my portfolio will throw off to fund my family's lifestyle both today and in the future. So it is a big concern in terms of, you know, from a country perspective, Emily, but I think our data doesn't show a huge difference between those near retirees and the retiree population.
I think, Nate, one thing that I think about a lot is that things change during a career, not just about the job that you have, how much money you make, your family circumstances, who you need to support, but also what types of products are out there that are available to people to save for retirement. Like the rise of target date funds comes to mind, and the rise of passive index investing comes to mind. How are you seeing that reflected in the surveys? Because for a lot of folks, they can just say, okay, well, I know what year I want to retire. I can throw it all in a target date fund that will change the older I get and the closer to retirement I get, and then I can forget about it.
Yeah, it's a great question, and one of our kind of more interesting findings, I would say, in this year's study. So we found that only 17% of near retirees preferred using target date funds over 52% of investors who are looking to use, let's say, the core menu to create their own portfolio. And that's a really stark difference, I would say, than the industry's perception of what will likely happen over time. If you look at today's 25 and 35-year-olds, they tend to leverage target date funds 80, 85, 90% of the time, right? That's one of the reasons why it's a $3 trillion marketplace. But as you move towards that retirement age, it drops down substantially. We've always kind of had this view that as people move towards retirement, they would continue allocating towards target date funds in those same kind of levels of utilization as they get older. This data tends to point to the fact that maybe that's not the case. Maybe people recognize that when they do become 55 or 60 years old, the differences between them and their colleagues start to matter a lot more. A quick aside on this, if you think about target date funds for, let's say, a 25-year-old, most of your total wealth is tied up in something called human capital, mm-hmm. right? Your future earnings that you're not going to spend and instead you're going to save. And because that's the largest portion of your wealth at that time frame, the three of us aren't that different, let's say, at 25 or 30 years old. But as time marches on and some of us might get married, have kids, be healthier than the other, expect to retire earlier or later, maybe have a longer, more lavish lifestyle in retirement, all of a sudden those differences, because our human capital starts to decline, matter a lot more. So while target funds have done an incredible service, we would say for tens of millions of Americans, I think it's fair to say that they're less optimal person to person at 55 than they are at age 25. And we're starting to see that in the data from our survey. So very interesting finding this year.
Nate, another interesting finding that I noticed in this survey was just how the already retired respondents talk about whether they made the right decision on timing when to retire. 37% of retired respondents said that they retired sooner than expected. 39% said they retired too late. How at Allspring do you kind of find that balance for potential retirees and your clients?
Yeah, so the main driver of when to retire is really financial. I think that was 47% of the time. That was the kind of key driver. But the qualitative response that we were getting from individual respondents was that trying to balance how much wealth I have or assets I have versus the quality of life that I'm looking for in retirement came up more and more in All Spring Survey this year, really for the first time that I can remember in the 7 years that I've been involved in the study. So that was a new nuance, Emily, that I think we're going to start to see more of on a go-forward basis. In general, I believe it was 65% or 69% of people were happy, were happier in retirement than they expected. But on average, about individuals wanted to work about 1 year longer than they otherwise did. And so many of them were forced out of the workforce, either for health reasons or reasons beyond their control, a little bit earlier than they had planned.
And Nate, we have about a minute left, but I want to go back to something you said about Social Security and the way that people think about Social Security. How should soon-to-be retired folks and people who are early on in their careers think about Social Security? Is it something that they should actually rely on when it comes to retirement planning? Or do you have the concern that it will not be available to the same extent that it is now?
Yeah, I do think there'll probably be means testing, you know, let's say in 25 or 30 years. I think that's a probable outcome. I think for people that are within 10 to 15 years of retirement, the likelihood that they'll see any substantial changes in that regard is pretty de minimis. So I think it's a real risk for people, let's say, in their 20s and 30s today. But the good news is they have the benefit of time. You know, our study focused on people that had more than $200,000 in assets, and that's a number that we would expect individuals that are fortunate enough to have an employer-sponsored DC plan to well exceed after 30 or 40 years of retirement, of savings for retirement, sorry.
Nate, really appreciate you joining us. We're going to have to leave it there. That's Nate Miles, head of retirement at Allspring Global Investments, joining us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline, it's teamwork, and it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is The Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Well, the S&P 500 pulling back on those gains, actually ending down now about 0.5% and snapping a five-week winning streak for the S&P 500. But there are still some bulls out there. It's time for Drive to the Close. We're joined with Sylvia Jablonski, CEO and CIO at Defiance ETFs, who joins us on Zoom from New York City. So let's start with your market thoughts, Sylvia. Is there still reason to be bullish, or have equities just run up too far, too fast, and we're starting to see that risk-off shift kind of materialize today?
Well, good afternoon, and thank you for having me today ahead of the long weekend here. I remain bullish on the markets. I think, you know, sort of two things happened. One is that CPI number came in a little bit hot. You know, 2024 started much along the lines of 2023. It was sort of a, you know, good year. Markets are up out of the gates, give or take a week. And then, you know, you had a little bit of a reset in between. Markets rallied again, and then the CPI number came in a little bit hot. We saw the market sort of recover from that as the retail sales number came in a little bit lighter. And then, you know, here we are again on the next inflation read and the markets are pulling back a little bit. But I think this is all just, you know, kind of short term, par for the course on our way to the Fed's inflation number. I think that wholly we're in a situation where inflation is going down. The economy remains on trend. You know, the economy is essentially growing and strong. Jobs numbers are good. Wages are good. Earnings are good, even though the bar was low. You know, we had great beats kind of across the board there. So I think that, you know, February, March tend to be kind of like slower months anyway. We're getting a pullback from the rips. And I think that they're just good opportunities to actually buy and, you know, right out the end of the year, which should be positive.
What do you consider an opportunity to buy at this point, Sylvia? I mean, is an opportunity like obviously Tuesday in hindsight was a good opportunity to buy, but how many of those are going to be out there at this point?
You know, every time you think that they've gone away, they come back. So I do think that when you get those days and, you know, if you've been sitting on the sidelines, as we know, there's trillions of dollars of cash that is just kind of sitting on the sidelines there, sitting these 4-5% treasuries, which is, you know, awesome. But if you think about what's supposed to happen later in the year, the Fed is going to cut rates. You know, we can sort of argue about whether that'll be 4 times or 3 times or 2 times, but we're going to get there and the Fed is going to cut rates. And so, you know, names like, you know, small cap stocks, for example, will benefit later in the year. Perhaps they won't work right now for investors, but if you, you know, kind of dollar cost average your way in, you'll get performance towards the end of the year. And then, you know, the Magnificent Seven, 2022 was a bear market. Last year was recovery. And I think now between AI, you know, quantum computing, supercomputing, these names are poised to just grow. And they're very, even though they've been, you know, kind of perfectly fine with rates being high over the last couple of years, the minute that rates get cut, you know, they are arguably in a better spot to continue to grow and thrive and really, you know, kind of benefit from the AI trend. So Mag 7 and then some of the unfavored, you know, small caps, those parts of the markets.
We've seen over the last few weeks, Sylvia, the market slowly start to walk back its expectations for just how many cuts we're going to have in 2024. But stocks seem to be okay with that. We're moving more in line with the Fed's projections of how many rate cuts we'll get, which is likely 75 basis points. But at what point is this not good for the equity market? If the market, you know, begins to price in, then we'll only see one cut for 2024. Is that going to be the moment where we do start to see stocks fall under pressure?
Yeah, that's a great point. So we saw stocks fall under pressure when we saw that CPI read, right? So that tells you that the market still does have this knee-jerk reaction to the idea that the Fed won't cut as much as you know, perhaps the market anticipates. So I think, you know, if we get in that realm of 3 to 4 cuts, I think everything will sort of be just fine. Maybe you have some bumps in the road if we get some reads that we don't like along the way, you know, if it's sort of not linear between now and May or June, you might see some pullbacks. But I think that overall, you know, we probably are on course to have some sort of cuts this year. And as long as that happens, I think, you know, it's kind of off to the races, or at least, you know, a decent 8-10% kind of that annualized S&P 500 average that we see. If, however, to your point, we get one cut or we get no cuts, then I think the year ends up kind of being a lost year and you end up seeing your profits kind of 2025 after the election year.
What's the biggest risk out there that you see in the near future? I want to bring up a note that came out earlier today. Bank of America's strategists are saying that bubble highs right now have seen dafter valuations, arguing that there are a host of similarities between tech stocks now and previous bubbles, suggesting that the Magnificent Seven is nearing, but not yet at levels that may lead to a pop. That's according to Bank of America analysts. What do you make of that?
Yeah, so I think, you know, if you look at the Mag 7 and you look at valuations, actually, interestingly enough, many of them actually have come down, right? So Amazon has a historical average of 118 or so. It's in the 40s now. NVIDIA's has come down. So what's happening is that these companies are actually earning and they're coming out with stellar earnings. They're cost cutting. They're becoming more profitable. So I think that so far they're justifying their valuations, you know, in terms of where that goes in the future has to be, you know, remains to be seen. I think they have to keep up with the earnings growth and they have to keep up with kind of producing on all of the quarterly earnings calls and things like this. But for me, I think, you know, what's the biggest risk to the market? You know, the biggest thing, obviously, I think would be inflation just going the wrong way and surprising us. And I don't think what we saw so far this week is just is terrible. They're kind of light misses. And then the second thing would be geopolitics, right? There's a whole lot going on in the world right now, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's Russia and Ukraine, you know, a lot of trading tensions and things like this. So those aren't things that we've really factored in.
Which geopolitics risk do you think is the biggest?
Oh, hard to say. I think that's, you know, what's going on in the Middle East could potentially, you know, go in a bad way beyond where we're at now. So I think that, you know, kind of all eyes are there and you know, what happens. So,
Tim, I just went to the ETF exchange conference.
Oh, you did. That's right. You did in Miami.
I think Sylvia was there too.
I was there too, yes.
Oh, you guys are so lucky.
We are just dying to talk about ETFs.
Oh, go. I mean, go ahead, please. Talk, go.
Sylvia, what were your, I guess, key takeaways from that conference? You know, over at Defiance, you guys have a lineup of thematic ETFs. Did you notice that people, investors, advisors were fired up about, you know, that sector? Or was there other, I guess, areas of ETF innovation that you noticed at the conference?
Yeah, so this is so interesting. I was actually talking to a colleague about this before. A couple of years ago, no matter what conference you went to, there was a big focus on ETFs that track Asia or the Asian region or, you know, tech in Asia or consumer discretionary in Asia or retail or, you know, just kind of the whole region in general. And then potentially India would have been second on that list and this expansion to EM and developed markets. And a lot of the talk about Bitcoin had gone away other than, you know, guessing whether or not that ETF would be approved. And I think this year, there were three things. One is ETFs that have options on them that have these, you know, enhanced income types of plays. I think there's so much interest out there. We've seen billions of inflows into that space. Thematics in terms of that, it's very much consistent with the market. So all of the flows have gone into the Magnificent Seven stocks. And so then all of the flows have gone into, I think, the tech-related ETFs that actually capture AI and quant. Our quantum ETF had its best year ever, basically, because it tracks AI and machine learning. And then the third thing is Bitcoin, right? That approval and just so many conversations about who's going to win, why, and whatnot. So that was super interesting. I think, you know, risk on sentiment is higher than it was a year or two ago, for sure, at the conference. But definitely more interest in these creative income options related products and AI and, you know, things along that path.
It definitely felt like every fund issuer booth I walked up to wanted to talk to me about their options overlay strategy income kind of ETF. But Sylvia, I do want to ask you about one of Defiance's largest ETFs, the Next Gen Connectivity ETF. It has over $580 million in assets. It's up 5% year to date. Why has that theme taken off this year, do you think?
Yeah, so I think so 5G and quantum are really our AI plays. So with quantum, you get the supercomputing, the processing of the data, the artificial intelligence aspect of it, the machine learning aspect of it. And with 5G is basically the connectivity required for all of these things to happen. So essentially, you need to have 5G for smart cars to work, for, you know, smart cities to be connected, in order for the data to be processed in an efficient way with lower latency so that you can get to these, you know, super efficient AI results. So that's why I think it's taking off this year.
Hey, Sylvia, happy Friday. Glad you guys got to hang out in Miami over the past few days.
We both look a little tan, even though the radio audience can't hear it.
That's Sylvia Jablonski, CEO and CIO at Defiance ETFs, joining us from New York City.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.